Yes, as I was saying,
this will connect also with things we talked about in connection with Pascal. And can you see this? I have, in this table, I've got a sort of a division on column on the left. We've got an Augustinian position. Old style Augustinian represented by Jansenists, but not only Jansenists. There were others who were not quite so extreme as that, but nevertheless felt, along with Augustine, that man is fallen, and in his fallen state, the reason itself is pretty badly off. Will is in a really, really, really bad state, and you need some radical work on it, radical effects of the grace of God, in order to do anything about that, to cause any improvement. Then, over on the, whichever, the other column, more optimistic Catholic positions. And in here, I say, man retains, and this is sort of coming from the Council of Trent and its aftermath, positions represented by Jesuits, among others. Man retains his essential freedom and a great capacity for good. Reason still functions quite well, which will needs the help of God, but that help is assured. Now, so essential freedom, okay, whereas for Augustine, the will is shot, is kaput, until God changes, transforms the heart. But it can't do that to itself. Whereas this position here is that we've got a lot that's still going for us in our will, in that particular faculty. And then our reason can't maybe do everything. And in this connection, they're not yet thinking, in at least this group of people, they're not thinking of scientific reason, of a geometric reason. They're talking about a more humanly limited kind of reason. That reason still functions quite well, as I say here. Okay, now, so I say, who holds these positions? Okay, Augustinian side, Jansenists, but also Dominicans, and no doubt others as well. And the Jesuits for the others, well, not the only ones, but they certainly were holding these more optimistic positions. And if we are to give any credence to what Pascal says in the provincial letters, they present more than one version of this optimistic view. One, a severe kind of Christian stoicism that says you've got to work hard, you've got to put a lot of effort in order to lead a good life and be a good Christian. But, by golly, you can do it. You can do it. And then another, this B, what I call Beal Deal, which is a mild version of this optimistic position, which can move towards accommodationism and laxism. That is to say, accommodation with the current culture. There's nothing you have to change. You're fine as you are. And even laxism. Okay. Now then I go back to ancient thought and sort of connect this up with, well, these old schools that, again, we talked about a little bit, but to show a kind of relationship, and I couldn't get them all into one table. Or if I did, it would have to be three or four dimensions. So you remember we talked about Stoicism. Reason alone should guide us. We must control our passions, never let ourselves be guided by them. And for many of them, life is a struggle. It's hard to do this. Epicureanism, pleasure, well-being, is our best guide for the practice of virtue and for the best kind of life. Even to be virtuous, you should look to pleasure. It is good to follow our desires with moderation and making use of reason as well. Life should not be a struggle. If your life is a continual struggle, something's wrong. Now, this is the position, if you like, or a large part of the position of a Montaigne, and I would say it is the position of Molière as well. That's what he's represented in his plays. Now, two versions of this for in our Christian setting. One, there is a kind of Christian Epicureanism that says, okay, not so much strain. You don't have to kill yourself in order to be a Christian. And then another attitude, which is really not Christian at all, but is libertinism, free thinking, saying, and basically, which is an atheism of materialism. There's no afterlife, there's no soul, probably there's no God, and we should make hay. That is to say, we should enjoy ourselves while the sun shines. Now, so I say, the conclusion to all this, four positions, sort of, that you might have available to people in the 17th century France, three of which are Catholic. conceivably. There's Augustinianism, Christian Stoicism, and Christian Epicureanism. And then at the far beyond the pale for religious thinking is libertinism. So, and here we have representatives of this, Augustinian, Jansenists, and others, Christian Stoicism, some of the Jesuits, Christian Epicureanism, others of the Jesuits, and libertinism, well, hopefully no Jesuits at all. Now, a big question. Now, people objected to, as soon as L'École des Femmes came out, people objected to the fact that, two things, partly that in it, Molière sets himself up as a teacher. And this is objectionable to church people, because they would say, we're the teachers of morality. We are the teachers of proper behavior. And not you, not a layperson, and especially not an actor. The worst of all people to be doing this. Second, they would object to the actual content of what he said. Now, L'École des Femmes is a fascinating play, and I recommend it to you. It basically is taking a farcical kind of a situation, or a commedia dell'arte kind of situation. That is, it's a story of an old guy who wants to marry a young woman, but and who is going to be deceived and be foiled in whatever he tries to do. In particular, young love is going to triumph. All this is stuff going back to new comedy in certain respects. But there are a lot of different popular elements that come into it along the way. What's interesting is that it is, well, in certain respects, it is elevated to a much higher level and made, in a way, far more serious. Now, the hero, so to call him, of this, or you could think he's the hero, unless he's the villain, Arnulf, is this guy, well, he's old, he's, you know, like, in his 40s. Around 40. And he has spent a large part of his adulthood criticizing the people around him, whose behavior doesn't come up to snuff as far as he's concerned. And in particular, in this town that they live in, which is not Paris, he is critical of people who, guys who allow themselves to be cuckolded and don't make any of a fuss out of it. Now, what he's planning to do, he's, of course, one solution to avoid this happening to you would be not to get married, since it happens so frequently, and especially not to marry a person younger than you are. He has another plan. He thinks he can deal with this in a different way. He has a woman in hand, a young woman, who has been his ward, and that he has made sure has been brought up in a special way, far from society, far from corrupting influences, and he has made sure that she has gotten a very limited education. Now, his plan is that he will marry her, and because she knows nothing and will never have any contact with other men, particularly young ones, then he'll have no problem with her, such as many others have. Well, it turns out, of course, this isn't so. And partly what happens, the education, who is the education? Is it by women, for women? Is it by women or is it for women? It could be either. The young woman, in fact, does go through an education, and it is an education that is given her by nature. In spite of this fellow, he is trying to control it with his mind and make it go the way he wants it to go. Now, it is also an education, though, of Arnulf, in a way, although he is not very receptive to it, that he has gone about this in completely the wrong way. That is to say, and this is an Epicurean kind of idea, that the proper relationship between reason and the passions, or between mind and the animal part of our being, is not a war and not forcing things on our animal selves against the inclination of the animal self, but rather it is a cooperation. And yes, our bodies, our emotional, animal, passionate selves need the help of reason, but reason should not get too far away from the material, human kind part of existence, and in fact should always be sort of having that as its goal, that is to say, it's the thing it's taking care of. So, and not neglect it in view of some abstract notion of an ideal that has nothing to do with our actual situations. Now, that's his problem, and he never, it's sort of, it's shoved in his face, or his face is shoved in it by the end of the story, but he never, I don't know that he ever really gets the lesson, but that lesson is available for him if he wanted to have it, and it is available for other people. Now, points that Baudrillard was making in this story were, and this all the while that he's using elements of farce all the way through this story, are, okay, you shouldn't have a great disparity of age in marriage. That's one thing. And physical attraction is important. And you shouldn't neglect it or act as if it didn't have any importance at all, or you could disregard it or act contrary to it. What else? Women should be educated, at least, up to a point. More than this guy is willing to allow, that women should be educated. And they should have contact with society so that they will have a way, they'll know how to deal with it. They will know how to deal with, say, perils or temptations that may come their way, and will not be so miserably unhappy that they'll be inclined to give in to them for that reason, just to escape from their situation. So it is a sort of an Epicurean ideal that is being expressed here, and one that is appreciative of nature and does not think of the proper relationship between intellect and desire as being one of continual warfare. Now, well, as I say, they protested against this layperson, and especially this particular kind of layperson, daring to set himself up as a teacher of morals. And then, he also, at least one of his characters, in formulating a certain ideal, a human attitude, goes a little bit far. And if you take this person as a spokesperson from Molière, it is rather shocking what this Chrysalde, who is a confidant of Arnulf, says in the first act one, scene one. He says, you know, you can't control people. And husbands, ultimately can't control their wives. So if your wife decides she's going to cuckold you, well, that's just the breaks. It's like any other misfortune that could happen to you over which you have no control. And therefore, just, you gotta suffer it, and don't make a big fuss about it, because it just makes you more ridiculous. Whereas you might have a kind of a dignity if you take it stoically, so to call it. there are some of the expressions of Chrysalde are, I find myself, kind of shocking. For one thing, he acts as though there's nothing you can do about this, like trying to develop a good relationship or communication with your wife or things of this sort. No, if they're going to do it, they're going to do it. You just got to let it slide. So there are this sort of... Now, Chrysalde says, now, I don't approve of this, and of course you shouldn't go around, theoretically, of course he doesn't really talk about this, spouses should not be cheating on each other. But if your spouse does it, you have no control, complete control over what that person is going to do, and in matters like this, the more you try to control it by means of force, of terror, the more it's going to backfire. Now, that certainly is what happens to the hero, if he is the hero. But as I say, there's something really that people could maybe legitimately characterize as laxism, or at least the argument, the objection is not completely without force, at least insofar as the attitude of Chrysalde is concerned. Now, okay, so he got into trouble with that, and then, as I say, we go on to Tartuffe, and oh boy. Now, talk to me about Tartuffe, your thoughts, your reactions. Oh, wait, yes, sir.
It did, well, I don't know. I guess there's a significant difference between, baroque clerics and myself, but I didn't find it that offensive, because he's clearly a hypocrite of, Christian parts.
That's right. That's right. He's not a. He's not. Yes. Yes. He's not really a holy person.
No, you're quite the.
So he's not criticizing holy people.
No.
And that indeed is what he says, or what the person who in this is his spokesperson, who is Kayant here. That's what he says. Well, I mean, they're you know, perfectly holy people, and they're perfectly fine. But this guy's a different story. Okay, but how do you distinguish them, according to Kayant? The good holy people, the good pious people, and the bad pious people who are hypocrites. Yes, ma'am?
Well, he says that good pious people are humble, you know that they're humble, but you never really know what they're doing, and they don't criticize other people. They just try to be themselves holy, and by their example, you want to be humble.
Yes.
They're not criticizing others.
Yes. They don't criticize other people. Now, so that, of course, is. Now, notice what the implication here is. So, okay, the good pious people, the good holy people, the good extra fervent Christians, practice mortification and whatnot for themselves. They don't demand that everybody else do it, and they're not constantly criticizing other people for not doing so and calling attention to themselves as models and so forth. This implies, okay, now on the other hand, we have this character who is Tartuffe and is constantly doing that, and who is also a hypocrite. And what he's after is power and pleasure in this world. And he's using religion of the appearance of piety as a means. The implication is, I think, that if you are a kind of Christian who criticizes what other people do and wants to hold them to a higher standard, then you are a hypocrite. Then you are a false, or well, the term is faux dévot, a false devout, a false pious person, falsely pious. Now, this is saying a bit more than simply hypocrites are bad news, and nobody likes hypocrites. This is saying anyone who makes a big noise about the high ideal of the Christian life, and now we need to reform society, all of us need to be doing a better job, then these are fighting words. Yes, ma'am. Well,
Tartuffe
is a
yes.
Has many, many vices all rolled into one. But it is understandable to me how enthusiastic, severe kinds of Christians who are not hypocrites would be upset about this play, by the implications of the play. Now, for instance, so Jansenists wouldn't fit in. Now, they may not make a big noise about themselves, but they say, well, you people are not Christian. You're not living your Christian life until you really, really change your ways. And then Christian Stoics would be the same, be treated possibly the same way if they say, here's this high ideal we've got to live, and we can do it, but you've got to do it. You've got to change in important respects. This is something that also they might feel themselves attacked in this attack on Tartuffe, on sort of noisy religion. What else? In other words, you could say, or put it another way, what he's saying is, religious people are okay, they're fine, if they don't make trouble, if they don't upset our habits. Now, our habits, of course, as he presents it, are perfectly okay. What is it that the religious folks criticize? What do they not like? What do they not like? Now, there's Madame Bernet, the mother of Olgon. What does she dislike in what the people around her do? This is in the very first scene. Fabulous scene. Sorry?
Gossip. Able to another little jab of Moniere's against these people. Like they're really they're just bitter from the fact that they can't have these things themselves anymore.
That's something that comes up, but that's sort of the point of view of the other people, not of Madame Bernard herself. So what is this all slid away?
She doesn't like parties.
Sorry?
She doesn't like parties.
Parties, exactly. I don't know who said that, but it's true. She doesn't like parties. She doesn't like people coming and going. Well, what do? They go visit each other. They go to these salon-like things, you know, and they'll go, you know, pass the time of day. Or they might go to the opera or a play, or I suppose they have dance sort of things that they might go to. And especially they enjoy each other's company, for goodness sake. And there's too much noise, too much fun, too much coming and going, too much yin and yang, probably also too much contact with other people, which is, well, it's promiscuity, by its very definition. Now, yes. The ordinary pleasures of life that Moliere presents as perfectly innocent, that's what they go after. And so it is something they want to twist human behavior into something completely, not simply that is virtuous, but completely unnatural. And in doing so, they're likely to do great harm, as indeed, of course, Ogon is likely to do in trying to force his daughter to marry this man that she loathes, whereas she's got this perfectly good young fellow that she's in love with, and in fact they have an agreement with. okay, so what we have in this particular scene, the wonderful first act, and of course one of the amazing things about this play is that you don't see the main character until the third act. So you have all these people talking about him, talking around him and so forth, preparing for his arrival on the scene, on the stage, but you don't actually see him. But many, many important things happen. And, of course, there's the fabulous encounter between, Madame Bernard, when she's going out the door, and she's got all the members of her family around her that she is dominating and yet treating as if she is the person who is disrespected and is being practically thrown out of the house and so forth. Of course, she is a devotee of this Tartuffe fellow. And then we come to understand that Ogon, of course, is also, who doesn't show up until the end of the act, he also is under the power, the influence of this Rasputin-like fellow. Now, of course, it takes two to tango in this world. That is to say, in this particular play, you have to have a scoundrel who is very clever in many, many ways, but can't fool all the people, working in tandem with a person who is, in fact, a fool. Now, so, and that is Ogon in this case. And what is characteristic of Ogon? Well, we have this discussion here. Oh, of course, this very, very funny part. And I don't know if you realize how funny it is. You have to see it performed, and performed in a particular way. And there's a lot of sort of a farce-like element, the comedy of repetition. Also, an important feature of Molière's plays that, for instance, is just about completely absent from Shakespeare, and I sometimes wonder whether they're plays at all, is mugging. That is to say, expressions and stage business. but that's very important. The expression is on your face. Are very important at certain points. Anyway, let's see. Dorine, okay. He says, Cléant is trying to speak to him about important things, particularly the marriage of his son or his daughter or something, his children. Okay. But he has to find out about how's the family been doing. But all he really cares about is, of course, Tartuffe. Even though, and then we have this fabulously funny section where the maid is talking, Dorine is talking about how his wife had this terrible sickness they thought she was going to die from. You wonder if she's making this up. Whereas Tartuffe is perfectly well the whole time, and that's all he has ears for. Well, there's a way to do this, or present it, stage it, where it really, the way I've seen it done, and it's really good, this just says, le pauvre. So, good way to do it is really make this exaggerate.
the Pauvre, after she said how well he's doing and so forth. And this happens repeatedly. Okay. And Dohine, of course. Dohine is the type of, and this is, you know, a popular, this comes from many different sources, but is the clever servant who is smarter than many of her masters, smarter of all of this family, and who helps people get what they need. Okay, couldn't get to speak. Tartuffe. I said, pour le pauvre homme. Okay, and Tartuffe? Et Tartuffe? Le pauvre homme. Okay, it goes on. Okay, now she leaves, and that's why we have a new scene. And Cléon is obvious to Cléon. Dohine was making fun of him. But Argot is, he's oblivious. Okay, now in this scene, between the two of them, you have Cléon express his point of view. And I think, again, I think he is a kind of a porte-parole, a spokesperson for Modiella. And he presents the middle of the road, and very much the sort of Christian, if you like, but Epicurean Christianity, that ideal, which is not one of extreme violence that you work on yourself. Okay, turning on your perceptions. Now, this is a very, very funny, this description he has of how he first met Tartuffe. And it's wonderful because, well, very important for any playwright is to be able to express character through words. But here we go beyond that, and we the expression of Argot's understanding of things, but we also see what the Tartuffe character is really doing. And what is his aim is this? Argot is blind to it, but we can see it through his blindness, or in spite of his blindness. And, oh yes, every little thing that he does is so... It's very funny, very funny. At any rate, Cléon later on will express his point of view, which has certain things in common, at least, with the Crisole of the other play. Okay. Now, yes. In the end, okay, this is, I think, one of the long speeches where Cléon goes on and on about what the proper attitude is and how you guys, the problem with you, Argot, and people like you, is you go from one extreme to another. You don't understand moderation and the appropriateness or the importance of moderation. Everything has to be extreme for you to be able to grab a hold of it. And it's when it is extreme in these matters, that extreme as you seem to prefer it, you've got something false. And Argot, this is their typical attitude, Tartuffe does this too, or their ploy, when they're backed into a corner in reasoning, they'll just say, well, I don't know. And that is one way of dealing, and so forth. And so that's basically the end of this scene, or close to it. Well, it seems like it's going on. I'm wrong about that. But at any rate, oh, no, we're going on to another scene. Here I have these very, very famous scenes where Tartuffe, of course, we have learned, we've been there hints of this from the very beginning, from the almost the first scene. Yeah, I think the first scene, that Tartuffe has the hots for El. Is she El Mia or El Via? I always get them mixed up. I think it's El Mia. Sorry? El Mia. Right. Okay. he has the hots for her. And one of the reasons why he doesn't want people coming around is because he wants to have El Mia to himself. Okay. And she's just asked him this business about, well, wait a minute, aren't you a religious guy? She's getting, finally it's becoming clear to her what he has in mind. Aren't you supposed to love eternal things and not, you know, earthly beauty, physical beauty? Love for the beauty of eternal things cannot destroy our love for earthly beauty. Our mortal senses well may be entranced by perfect works that heaven has fashioned here. He comes, works into a justification, using religious language as much as he possibly can for his own lust and desire to fulfill his lust and so forth. All right, the language here is rather wonderful in its sliminess, and he ends up being, oh, this horrible combination of sort of extremely galant in the way that French people would like, but at the same time, yes, it's horrible religious language that he combines it with. It's very, very slimy. Okay, and Mia, oh yes, though pious, I am nonetheless a man. Yes, and so she's getting him to express things more and more clearly, I guess, although that will become more important later on.
how is she going to deal with it? We never get to see, because then her son, who is, by the way, is not her own son, it's her stepson, he bursts out of hiding and won't let it go on. Okay. Oh, now, here we get. Okay, here we get. Now, this is something you might find in, sometimes expressed by medieval writers. In fact, you find it in the Art of Courtly Love, which is certainly in support of, the kind of love it's talking about is love that has nothing to do with marriage and is often enough adulterous. And they talk about various questions, technical questions, some of them. For instance, can love occur in marriage? Not appropriate is the answer, because that's a contract. You're not free. And the kind of love we're talking about is something that is completely free. Okay. Then another question is, who make the better lovers? Knights or clerks? Knights or priests? Knights or religious guys? And the answer is clerks. And one of the reasons is, the reason that it gets here. Okay, they're more discreet. And that's what he says. This is getting quite horrible here. With me, your honor runs no risk. With me, you need not fear a public scandal. These court gallants that women are so fond of are boastful of their acts and vain in speech. They always brag in public of their progress. Soon as a favor is granted, they'll divulge it. Their tattling tongues, if but you trust to them, will follow the altar where their hearts are worshipped. But men might leave, are so discreet in love that you may trust their lasting secrecy. So he's making a virtue of his hypocrisy. And the fact that he needs to hide the fact that he is a lustful person as much or more than anybody else. The care we take to guard our own good name may fully guarantee the one we love. So you may find, with hearts like ours, sincere, love without scandal, pleasure without fear. Oh, wonderful, these antitheses. What a horrible, horrible person, but he's a great arguer. He always has a way to defend what he wants to do and make it fit with the role that he is playing. Now, the other famous scene, okay, or the other famous encounter here, again with Tartuffe and Mia, is when she finally gets him to come back, and she's going to pretend to give in to his wishes. This is so that her husband will hear and finally be convinced of what this guy is really like. And here we have wonderful, when he finally gets going, he's doubtful, and she's trying to convince him that she really does have a little feeling for him and so forth, and she's encouraging him to try again. What he says, I guess, in this, or shortly, a lecture coming shortly, or a harangue coming shortly of his, I'm not sure where it is now. Oh, yes, and he says, c'est un scélérat qui parle. He felt that he had to put this in the published form. So this is not what real religion is like. He's a combination of all kinds of horrible things. Basically, he's an atheist. He's the worst of libertines. But at the same time, he presents himself as the severest of pious people, with the highest of standards for himself and for other people. And at the same time, this is something that really is staggering and beggars belief, at the same time, he is also a casuist of the worst Jesuit sort. So he's like a Jansenist, but he's also like a Jansenist. That is to say, he's an accommodator. He will work out some way for you to be able to sin the way you want to sin. So he brings in, now this is something that's been already, the provincial letters are certainly a well-known text, and the complaints about certain Jesuit teachers, moral teachers, are very current. And so this is another kind of bad religiosity. Oh, let's combine it all together, get it all into this one speech. I can dispel these foolish feels, dear madam. I know the art of pacifying scruples, heaven forbids. Heaven forbids, 'tis true, some satisfactions. But we might find means to make things right with heaven. How do you do it? Well, like mental reservation, and by, well, probable teaching and so forth. There is a science, madam, that instructs us how to enlarge the limits of our conscience according to our various occasions, and rectify the evil of the deed according to our purity of motive. Purify your intention. This is straight out of complaints that Pascal and others would have made of Jesuit moral theology. I'll duly teach you all these secrets, madam. You only need to let yourself be guided. Content my wishes. Have no fear at all. I'll answer for it and take the sin upon me. So the funny is, the coffee is a sign that, or she's trying to use that as a sign to get her husband to come out. But he, for some reason, he won't do it. Your cough is very bad. Yes, I'm in torture. Would you accept this bit of licorice? The case is obstinate enough, fine, and all the licorice in the world will do no good. It is very trying. More than words can say. At any rate, in any case, your scruple is easily removed. With me, you're sure of circusy, and there's no harm unless a thing is known. The public scandal is what brings offense, and secret sinning is not sin at all. And it's all, well, as I say. Eventually, we get to the end of it when finally, Olgo does come out. Now, okay, various things. Most improbably, but very delightfully, he brings together these different kinds of religiosity in this one character. The extreme severe approach, whether Jansenist, whether Augustinian or Stoical, and the laxist accommodationist approach, and simple atheism are all present in this guy. Now, he is a clever guy, though. He's very smart, and he is very capable in certain ways, at least dealing with certain kinds of people. And people have commented, this is what people will often say, with regard to this character, and that is that, in a way, Mugia seems to find something admirable in Tartuffe. And this would be sort of the non-classical element. That is to say, he's drawn, this is more romantic, or if you like, Baroque, he's drawn to the power of this guy, the cleverness of this guy, the fact that he uses language so well, although it is not a use of language that fools everybody, but it fools a lot of people, and it is extremely artful. Well, that kind of an intelligence, that kind of ability to use language, and that kind of ability to play a role is something that a smart, very capable, accomplished playwright would feel a certain appreciation for. and people sometimes say that. But Tartuffe is a kind of a, if you want to take a romantic point of view or an anarchistic point of view, he's the one who wants to pull down society, or he wants to use the conventions of society, whatever they may be, in order to get ahead and promote number one. Okay, what else is I going to say about that? There's also a certain similarity, and this is another thing that people very often say, between a character like the hero villain of L'École des Femmes, Arnulf, and this guy, namely, extreme intelligence, almost an extreme of intelligence, almost an excess of intelligence. It is an intelligence that thinks it can control the world of nature, especially human nature, in a way that is not inherent to that nature, to that natural world, but is either according to some abstract notion of how you want people to behave and think they should behave, regardless of certain considerations of human happiness and so forth, or it is use of intelligence to deceive people and to get what you want, always to have power and pleasure in the greatest possible degree. Right. When we go eventually to Don Juan, here we have, well, what do you say about Don Juan? No thoughts? He is? Yes, sir.
No doubts. Like, he's not, he has no, he's a completely self-assured person.
He is self-assured.
He has no scruples.
Okay, where does he fall on the scale of philosophical positions as I presented them? He's all this direction, completely in this direction. He is, yes, he is an atheist. He is what people imagined a free thinker to be. Doesn't believe in supernatural, doesn't believe in an afterlife,
and thinks that consequently you've got to pay attention to number one and live. Well, basically, it is Epicureanism as hedonism. Yes, ma'am.
Usually doesn't care. However,
yes, usually.
Yeah.
Except amongst the many roles that he does put on, because it does deceive people.
Well, yeah. I mean, he uses it if he needs to like get the woman he wants, but it's not like he really, like, especially when he's talking to the servant, he's just really upfront. He's just all like.
Indeed, he is. He's more outspoken than Tartuffe would ever be. That's partly because he is nobility, and to some extent is protected by his status. Now, Tartuffe comes from a little village. He's practically a peasant. Apparently, he's grubbing to get ahead. Well, that's part of it. He's broke in the sense of, if you want to think of the hero is typical of Corneille, who is very self-confident, who knows what his set of values is, and is going to act in accordance with those no matter what. So he's perfectly free, if you like, to follow what he thinks is the truth or the right way in a certain sense. Now, however, he does end up, his last ploy is to become a hypocrite. And if he had lived longer, you know, that particular disguise he might have maintained for a long time. He might have become Tartuffe, perhaps a little bit higher level than Tartuffe. But he wants to get in good with his father once again, because that is important for reasons of inheritance and so forth. and therefore, he doesn't want to, or has decided that it's not going to work ultimately or for very long to continue to be outspoken about his beliefs and the way he wants to behave. Therefore, he's got to begin concealing it. Now, it's at this point that other things intervene, namely the stone guest, or the stone guest, as Peter Schindler would have, who comes and takes him to hell. But if he hadn't done that, perhaps we'd have seen more of this false piety. So he hasn't given up entirely this rancor against, well, he has rancor against the really harsh, critical, pious sort.
Well, it also seems to show just kind of human self-interest, because at the end of the play, his servant's like, oh gosh, he's dead, my wages. Like, in the end, even the servant is self-interested in the fact that he doesn't care that he's dead, because he kind of thought of him as despicable, but now I don't have wages, now I'm not going to make a living. Kind of.
Yes. Like, yes. Now, the servant is another problem. That's part of one of the reasons why people were very critical in their response to this play. Yes, ma'am?
I was just wondering, you said that you felt like he he had his certain beliefs that he was right. But do you really think he felt that he was right, or do you just think it didn't matter that he was doing what he was doing because he felt there was no consequences other than his father?
One or the other. That is to say, he's perfectly confident in the conclusions of his reason. And after that, given that, it doesn't matter how you behave. So he's going to behave the way he wants to. But in a certain sense, he is what he thinks is true. The basis for his behavior is what he thinks is true. It's truly true.
That there's no consequence.
That there is no supernatural, there is no punishment, and that all we have is this life here. Now, yes.
What do you do with him saving the life of the guy in the forest, not knowing that it was the brother of the woman that he had spurned? I mean, that's just so random.
Well, random if you like, but you could say it is characteristic of this. It fits in with his aristocratic manner or style of life, which, and along with this complete immorality in the domain of sex, is or human relations when it involves a female, is there is something about it that is attractive. And again, there's this notion, this idea that people rightly or wrongly say that
there's something about these characters, even though they're presented as villains, that Mengele finds intriguing at the very least. Now, and so some people would say, even in his own lifetime, this is Mengele. This is what Mengele is really like. This is what he thinks. And conceivably, he did. But I don't think he can know. I don't think he can really know that.
It may be that he thought, as he presents, say, Cléante, presenting things as a reasonable kind of Christianity. But you really can't know, I don't think. In any case, there are certain things about this guy. Then there is the odd business about how he meets the poor man in the forest, because they're meeting people all the time that you might not expect. This poor guy said, please, for the love of God, give me some money. I said, well, what is... So we have this conversation, which is a very impious conversation between Don Juan and this poor man. And he says, will you renounce God, or I forget exactly what he says, or blaspheme, and I'll give you money. He says, no, I won't do that. I'd rather die. And so in the end, he still gives him the money. What he says, pour l'amour d'humanité. I don't know how it says in this translation. For the love of humanité. Which can mean, you might think, oh, because I love human people. I'm not sure that he does. Humanité can also mean, and this goes back to a Latin meaning of it, use of a classical, kindness, being kind to other people. So it's sort of out of love for this, in, sort of in the abstract, for this idea of, you know, you should be generous, particularly if you're noble and you've got money. No reason not to. Pardon?
He likes to play the part of the dashing gentleman. Like the
yes.
Nobility.
Although it doesn't present itself necessarily as a part, but
yeah.
that is just as upfront as everything else that he does through most of this. Now, as I say, you have his very frank expression of these materialistic ideas. And on the other hand, the thing that people found very objectionable was that Sganarelle here is so perfectly worthless as a representative, which he is in this play, of the religious point of view. He can't argue. So what is it? He gets into an argument with a guy. So this is not like we don't have somebody like Cléante, you know, who is a good arguer, or Chrysalde, and backs his interlocutor into a corner. No, that doesn't happen here. So what is he doing? Yes, the wishbone is connected to the other kind of bones, and he gets himself twisted around, falls down. This is one of the visual pieces of humor that you have in Molière's plays. And therefore, voilà ton argument à la nez cassé. So your argument has its nose broken because he's fallen down like this as he was arguing his point of view. But so this is shocking that, as I say, the person who represents the opposite point of view is, and through most of the play, of course, you have an Elvire, and you have the father who comes in and so forth, but they don't last for very long. So it's usually this guy who's so very comical and who mixes up religion or sort of religious ideas, or at least a comfort with the conventions of religious teaching, with superstition. And this too was something that was very shocking and that he had to take out in certain editions of the play. So now, this is to say, I don't conclude from this that, or what I do like to think, or do sometimes think, is that we don't have what a character or a play out of control here, although it's certainly not as tidy as some of the others. but we do have a significant points of similarity between this character and other great characters, such as the ones I've mentioned, Arnulf and Tartuffe. And I think he is an excessive character, or you can interpret it that way. Not simply the fact that he makes love to one woman after another, with that wonderful speech towards the beginning in the second scene, I think, where he expresses the essence of Don Juanism. The ideal presented in Molière's plays is one of moderation and a certain kind of restraint, but you never go too far in any direction if you're going to live a good
and sociable and serviceable human life. And one of the ways you can go too far in being stupid. But you also can go too far in being smart. And that's what these characters do, these three. They are, of course, they're foolish in their own ways, or blinded. Some, Arnulf, more obviously than the others. But their very smartness leads them into folly, if you like, or into a bad end of some kind or other. Although you may need, it is true, in the case of, in a sense, in all three cases, you need a deus ex machina in order to save you. You definitely need that in Tartuffe. If it hadn't been for Louis, you know, who comes in and sort of is a character in the play, almost, Tartuffe would have gotten away with it. In a way, you also have it's sort of the mechanics of the comical situation in L'École des Femmes, but if you didn't have things from outside the story saving these characters, then they wouldn't have been saved. And so here you need a demon from hell, a ghost from hell, in order to save the day too. But nevertheless, I think this is a reasonable way to look at it. These are people who are not using reason in the way that reason is best used. Was there another comment or something that someone's going to say? Expressed not just legend, but there in the play versions of it, the Spanish and the Italian versions of the story. It's already there. The stone guest. So, yes, he's a guest because he's a stone, and he invites him, of course, at the end there. Will you come have dinner with me? It's the statue of the man he killed. and yes, by golly, he says, it is Nogs. Of course, very famous now in the operatic version. But there are a bunch of play versions before, before Mungar wrote his. So, and this is something you want to do quick and dirty, and you know, so he's just, but lots of the ideas. Okay, well, we seem to be sort of at the end, and what else would I have talked to you about? Yes, close to the end. Well, oh, I did want to talk to you about the other great, great play, which is, oh, and this funny, funny conversation here. Oh, it's wonderful. okay. Oh, I don't think I have here at all, but about Le Misanthrope, the misanthrope, which is another in this series of great heroes or villains. He's definitely a hero, but he has his problems. And he's another one, similar to these guys, in that he thinks he can control nature by means of reason alone, or if you like, virtue, his notion of virtue alone. This is not so specifically a religious context here, but definitely a philosophical and definitely a moral context here. And he is a representative of, certainly, a kind of lay stoicism. He is a Stoic. And he thinks that, yes, there's a right way to behave and there's a wrong way to behave. And you can do it if you set your mind to it. And he certainly thinks you should be critical of people when you see that they're not behaving as they should. And you can convert people. You can convert people if you just, you know, with a little effort and maybe goodwill, you can change him around. That's what he thinks. Okay. Now, and he is definitely, whatever you might think about these other hero-villain types, this guy who is, what is his name? Alceste? Alceste is his name. He is a very attractive character at the same time that he's very irritating. And one of the reasons you know he's attractive is because there are other characters who are estimable people in the play who like him a lot and hang with him even when he's being his most outrageous and irritating. But this is also, I think, someone who's gone too far with the heady side of things and has been misled because of that. Too great a trust in either the intellectual or in a kind of a moral ideal that is an abstract and inhuman. So there you are. So all of that has something to do with the Baroque. But you can figure out what that is. All right, so see you next time. Our subject will be Calderon, and I think, all right?
Sueño.
Yeah. Well, now I have not looked for it myself. I'm going to turn this thing off. There we go.